The following is an excerpt from the Science Magazine podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
David Graham, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about scanning for schizophrenia. What kind of scanners are they using for that, Dave?
Well, Rob, this is a brain scanner, and the study is all about, you know, you and I can go to our doctor and say, you know, I want to test for high cholesterol to see if I'm at risk, say, for heart disease. But we can't go to our doctor and say, hey, can you give me a test to see if I'm at high risk for schizophrenia or any other type of mental illness? Researchers just haven't developed a good diagnostic for predicting whether people are going to develop these types of disorders. So this study is all about, can researchers find maybe something in the brain, some sort of telltale sign that will tell them whether somebody's at a higher risk for developing, say, schizophrenia.
So an fMRI or functional magnetic resonance imaging, that kind of brain scan?
Right. This kind of scan measures blood flow in the brain, and the regions that have more blood flow are considered more active. And what the researchers found in this study is that there seems to be three regions of the brain under fMRI that are different between people that are schizophrenic and people that don't have schizophrenia. And two of these regions are in the frontal cortex. But the most interesting region was this 5 millimeter long part of the hippocampus that's called the CA1 subfield. And the hippocampus is a part of the brain that's involved in learning and memory. And what the researchers saw in this CA1 subfield was that they saw a lot more activity in this region in people that had schizophrenia versus people that didn't have schizophrenia. You know, this is important in itself because researchers are always looking for parts of the brain that are involved in mental illness. But it doesn't tell us anything about prediction because these people already had schizophrenia. But the researchers said, well, you know, if people that have schizophrenia have more activity in this region, maybe this region can be used as a marker for schizophrenia. Maybe people that are going to develop schizophrenia also have more activity in this region. And so that's really the diagnostic part of this study, was that they took 18 patients with what are called prodromal symptoms. And these are symptoms that about 75% of people that go on to develop schizophrenia have. They're things like, you know, mild hallucinations, like hearing voices whispered in the wind, or paranoia, you know, you think your friends are saying something behind your back. And so researchers took 18 people that had these symptoms, and they followed them for 2 years, and occasionally they do fMRI scans. And what they noticed is that about 70% of these people that actually went on to develop schizophrenia showed 50% more activity in the CA1 region than people with these prodromal symptoms that didn't go on to develop schizophrenia. So this, you know, even though it's not perfect, this is the most powerful indication researchers have so far that somebody may go on to develop schizophrenia.
So it's not a test then for people of the general public, but people who are already potentially on the road towards schizophrenia.
Right. The analogy the researchers use is somebody who already has, say, a family history of heart disease going in to have their cholesterol levels checked versus somebody who has no history. So this test right now would really be most useful for people who already feel like they may be predisposed to some sort of mental illness rather than just an average member of the general public.
So they might be able to start treatment earlier.
Exactly.
Okay. So what other stories have we brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, this next story is about two different bird species that sing the same song.
The birds can't tell the difference? What's the song used for?
Well, Rob, this is a territorial song. This is a song a male bird would sing to tell other males, hey, get off my property. This is my area. I want you to go away.
And it's an effective deterrent for both species?
Yeah, and that's what it turns out is really interesting about this study. Usually, you know, birds, when they have a song, it's very unique to their species, whether it's a mating song or a territorial song or whatever. But listen to these two songs. You're going to hear two different bird species. Here's the territorial song that a male from the first species makes. Now, here's the territorial song of a male from the second species.
It does sound the same.
And that's really unusual. And the question is, well, first of all, the question is, you know, it sounds the same to you and me, Rob, but does it sound the same to the birds? And it does. And the birds we're talking about here are South American antbirds. The two species are one called the yellow-breasted antbird, and the other one is called the Peruvian antbird. And what's really sort of interesting here is you wouldn't expect these birds to sound very similar. First of all, they've been separated genetically for over 3 million years, so they've really been on these divergent evolutionary paths for a very long time. Also, they look differently. As their name implies, the yellow-breasted antbird has a yellow chest, and the Peruvian antbird actually has a white chest. And there's a bunch of other differences. But as you can hear, the songs sound very similar. But the researchers wanted to see, do the songs actually sound similar to the birds? And so they taped over 500 songs from over 150 birds of both of these species. And they also taped some territorial songs of some related species. And what they found was that when they played these songs to either of these two antbird species that we mentioned, the birds couldn't distinguish them. So if you played a song from the first species to the second species, it reacted as if a bird was invading its territory and it came flying in trying to get rid of this other bird. But if they played either of these two species songs from another related species, the birds didn't react. So the birds can tell the difference between their song and songs from other species.
So what do researchers suppose is going on here?
Well, what they think is going on is these two birds, although they usually in different habitats, there are some areas where they live in the same place. One bird tends to prefer forest and the other tends to prefer bamboo, but there's areas in the Amazon that are both forest and bamboo, and you can find these two birds overlapping. And the idea is it's more efficient evolutionarily if these birds sing the same song. If a bird from the first species sings a territorial song that says, "Get off my property," if it's understood by bird B, he can get rid of both males from his own species and males from this other species by singing the song, rather than, say, having to sing two different songs or there being some confusion about exactly what's going on.
Because otherwise they'd compete for the same resources.
And researchers say this is a case of convergent evolution. Convergent evolution basically means when two different species evolve the same kind of traits. Imagine, you know, a fly has wings and a bird has wings, but they're obviously very completely different types of organisms. And here you have a case where these birds have evolved the same song, even though they are different species that have been separated by a long time.
Or they might have just kept the same song for 3 million years.
Yeah, that's possible too.
Okay, so last story this week. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, this last story is also about evolution, and it deals with a big question in evolution, which is, how do we evolve new traits without messing up our genes? And this all goes back to how evolution works in the first place. You know, these mutations in various genes can cause new traits, you know, whether it's different eye color or height or whatever it is, or even more brain power. But mutations can also do bad things. Mutations can muck up a gene, and so they could disrupt a critical function, like, say, brain development that would kill you. So the question is, how does evolution work on these genes if there's such a good chance that these genes are going to get disrupted? And the answer seems to be that we make backup copies. So mutations can happen in one gene, and if things get mucked up, you've still got this backup.
And somehow the organism might use this backup or stick with the original gene?
Well, Rob, the idea is your body still has these two genes. So if one is still functional, even if the other one's mucked up, you're still producing, say, this critical protein or this critical function, whatever you need to survive. And in this new study, Rob, they looked at fish. And they wanted to see, you know, can we actually sort of force evolution to happen, you know, on this small laboratory scale? And they took these zebrafish, which are these tiny fish, very popular laboratory model, and they fed them a bunch of chemicals which would cause their DNA to mutate. And then they looked for unusual traits. And one of the fish had this interesting mutation which made it almost scaleless. It didn't have very many scales, and it's very reminiscent of a domestic carp breed that has been bred not to have scales to make it easier to clean. And when the researchers said, okay, what's causing, you know, we've just sort of caused evolution to happen on a small scale here. We've created these scaleless fish. What's causing this to happen? And they traced the scaleless attribute back to a gene called fibroblast growth factor receptor 1, or FGFR1. And they said, okay, we've seen these mutations in this gene. These mutations must be causing the scaleless appearance. is there a backup for this gene? You know, do these fish have a spare gene that allowed us to sort of work on this extra copy? And that's exactly what they found. They scanned the genome and they found that there was a backup of this FGFR1 gene. And that makes sense because this gene is actually so important that if you had really mucked up this gene, you would have killed the fish. The fish would have died as an embryo because it's so critical to development. But, you know, this is all done in the laboratory, Rob, and they wanted to see, does this actually happen in real life? So they went to carp, which also have this attribute, and they found that carp that has this special kind of scaling also has mutations in its FGFR1 gene. And just like the zebrafish, it has a backup of this FGFR1 gene that's completely untouched by mutations. So this is sort of a nice proof of concept that in the wild, organisms have these backup genes which stay relatively normal, but they have another copy which can get mutated and occasionally leads to new and important traits.
Now, they've done genome sequencing on a whole bunch of organisms at this point. How many of my genes have backups?
Well, it's a good question. I'm not sure if they know that, but they do know that about 25% of the zebrafish's 17,000 genes are duplicated. So we're talking about an enormous amount of duplication happening in the zebrafish's genome. And you would expect that a lot of other organisms also have this massive amount of duplication. And that also lends further credence to the theory that this duplication is really a critical part of how evolution works. It really gives all of us these backup genes that allows evolution to proceed and allows organisms to develop new traits over time because these critical genes are still backed up.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you covering on Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we're looking into a story about green neurons. And these aren't neurons that are the color green. These are neurons that are very energy efficient in the brain. And for Science Insider, the science policy blog, we're looking into a story about a very popular journal, Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and how it's changing an important part of how papers are submitted. This deals with a controversy about how this journal has accepted papers in the past. And also, there's been a new report released this week about the future of U.S. spaceflight. And it turns out, the report says that missions to the moon, Mars, and beyond are not feasible with the current budget. And so we're looking at what the implications of this report are for future U.S. space science. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.